Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Trade was the glue that held the fascinating, far-reaching world of the late Bronze Age together. Tin from Central Asia, copper from Cyprus and Sardinia, gold and glass from Egypt, exotic resins and wine in storage jars produced in Canaan, all of them traveled long distances to reach the people who wanted them. A multitude of connections, the stuff that created an interconnected and international world, all built off this foundation. When that trade declined around 1200 BC, that system of connections came to an end, with profound consequences that have often been described as the Bronze Age collapse. Few parts of this world show a starker contrast between the late Bronze Age and what followed than Mycenaean Greece. But what do we really know about trade in both the Mycenaean period and what came afterward? What kinds of things were traded, and in what quantities? And why did trade actually matter so much? Nobody is better suited to help us answer those questions than today's guest. Sarah Murray is an assistant professor of classics at the University of Toronto, and she is an expert on the archaeology of Greece in the late Bronze and early Iron Ages. Her work is focused on trade and its role in the Mycenaean economy, including a book entitled The Collapse of the Mycenaean Economy. She's also the author of a ton of different book chapters and articles and has conducted fieldwork in a variety of places around Greece. She currently serves as the co-director of the Bays of East Attica Regional Survey. Professor Murray, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So how did you get interested in archaeology and more specifically in the archaeology of Bronze and Iron Age Greece?
I don't have a really coherent story about my origins as an archaeologist. When I went to college, I really had no idea what I wanted to do. I didn't grow up in a sort of academic household, and I'm from a sort of a small town. So I sort of had no idea what I was doing in college, and I did terribly in my first couple years. And I was about to fail out when I just randomly took a Roman archaeology course. And I loved it, and all the teachers in the classics department who taught the archaeology classes were really great. And it really, like, sort of plucked me out of a very sort of dark and, like, doomed period of my life and gave me something to do. So I ended up majoring in classical archaeology and just sort of got really into the kind of work that you do, especially intellectual work in archaeological thinking. I think there's something really compelling to almost everybody about archaeology, and that, you know, it's so fascinating to think about human society in the past and how different it could be. And the just sort of general sense of wonder at the things that people could achieve, you know, without the kinds of, like, modern mechanical and technological advances that sort of we're blessed with. So I really enjoyed that aspect of things, which I think is true of most archaeologists. But I also really love, like, the puzzling aspect of archaeological work. Like, it's a really difficult thing to, like, figure out anything for sure about things that happened 5,000 years ago. And I like to sort of get my teeth into a problem and just sort of see if we can put together the evidence in a way that moves the meter on, like, knowledge a little bit further. It never goes as far as we would like. But for me, the fun part of archaeological work is sort of finding loose threads or little holes in our sort of tapestry of understanding and, like, tugging at them a little bit and seeing maybe what we could do to figure something new out.
There are some really good common threads between what you said there and what I've heard a lot of other archaeologists say, which, like, especially the kind of the combination of, like, pulling on those threads and trying to conceptualize a question and come to an answer. But then also the fact that you're usually using some pretty pragmatic means to get at answering that. Like, there seems to be a really interesting meeting in the kinds of people that choose that work, where you have to be able to think practically about the things that you're going to do and the approaches that you're going to take, while also thinking about the broader frameworks into which that pragmatic work fits. Like, it seems to be, it's a really interesting combination of things, and it tends to attract people who have disparate interests, I think. Like, there are a lot of people, I've talked to a lot of archaeologists who are simultaneously into very different things. And so it seems, I don't know, there's common threads there.
Yeah, I think that's another great thing about archaeology is the people who do it are very cool. It's fun to have a career where you're constantly meeting interesting characters and people who, like, have a lot of adventures. And I think my colleagues are one of the reasons I stay in archaeology, because everyone is very interested in lots of things, and there's just a sort of multitude of different personalities, which is fun.
I've never seen any academics who have more fun than archaeologists. Like, I think that's been my experience. I remember the last time I saw a professor of archaeology that I worked with when I was doing my master's degree, it was 6 a.m. and he had a flight, and I've never seen anybody's eyes look redder than that. And the reason that he was going home was because his prize gun dog was having puppies and he wasn't going to miss that. So he was flying from Michigan to Ireland specifically for this event after a hard night of drinking. And I felt like that really kind of summed up something about the discipline of archaeology.
Yeah. Yeah. For better or for worse, I think that that is true.
Yeah, absolutely. Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. So turning to your work a little bit, a lot of the stuff that you've worked on has focused on the transition from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. How appropriate do you think the label of collapse is for that transition?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in a way it's a little bit of a funny question that probably wouldn't have been asked maybe 20 or 30 years ago. But there has been increasingly sort of scholarly criticism of the idea of collapse as sort of the baggage that it carries with it, and the way it sort of shapes narratives or brings certain sort of value judgments to bear on sort of geopolitical events. I think there are valid reasons maybe to think about conceptualizing collapse with more nuance, right? Thinking more about these now very popular sort of ideas about resilience or just talking about change instead of collapse. But I would, in a way, sometimes academics get too clever for their own good. And that's part of the game, right? You have established ideas and your job is to sort of push back against them. And that's all part of a healthy discipline. But just looking at the evidence, at least in the Aegean, you know, you have some kind of identifiable institutional entities, right, that we call these Mycenaean states, whether it's one big Mycenaean state, different sort of minor polities that are somehow connected, whatever you want to call it. Most of the, at least archaeologically visible, trappings of those states do disintegrate or sort of disappear rather suddenly, you know, between the 13th and the 12th centuries BC. And I think it's hard to find a more appropriate word for what we see in the evidence than collapse. So to me, it has value as a term that communicates rather clearly and concisely sort of the totality of the evidence.
Something that was interesting to me in doing my reading about both the Bronze Age collapse specifically and the concept of collapse, like something that stuck with me is like, if you're going to call something a collapse, it's like it has to be bad for some people. Like there has to be actual bad things that happen. It has to involve some level of human suffering. And it seems fairly clear that what we call the Bronze Age collapse actually does involve that for at least some people, right?
Yeah. And certainly it was probably good for other people. Oftentimes disaster, you know, for somebody yields opportunity for somebody else. But you know, that doesn't mean that it was a sort of tumultuous thing to experience. Like, as much as I love like Mad Max movies and thinking about like what I would do, like if all the institutional like structures of my society suddenly disappeared, you don't really want to live through that kind of thing. I think it's generally very unpleasant for a lot of people. But I also think that like we don't have to think of collapse as necessarily a negative thing, right? I mean, we think of the collapse of the Soviet Union from our perspective as a good kind of collapse, right? That sort of opened up new possibilities for a lot of people who are living in a sort of government that we didn't think was very good. So I think you could call something a collapse. It doesn't mean you think it was a disaster. Like, it's so sad that the Mycenaean kings like lost their palaces. Like, to me, it's more like it's just describing what we see. Like, a Jenga tower collapses. I don't really care. It's not a good or a bad thing. It's just like, there was a tower and now there are a bunch of blocks on the ground. So to me, it's sort of a matter of fact description of what seems to have occurred.
It's something I think about a lot because I did my PhD on the fall of the Roman Empire. And like, I always tried to bear in mind that, like, just because a Roman aristocrat thought that this was a really bad thing doesn't mean that some, like, Vandal guy who was born, you know, way off in the forest of Germania and who ends his life living in what used to be one of those Roman aristocrats' villas with a really nice view of the Mediterranean, like, for him, those processes were great. Like, he really made out well from that, you know what I mean? And, like, probably the peasants who were getting taxed less in the aftermath of that were probably not sad about it either. Though they may well have been sad that some of them died in a plague or were killed in an invasion or something. Like, that's probably not ideal. But still, like, there's, yeah, it's calling something a collapse doesn't mean that everything goes to crap for everybody immediately and remains so forever in the aftermath.
Yeah. I think, you know, obviously human society is always more complicated than that. And, you know, I think in the long run, there can be ways that collapse benefits people. So I think the best example is, like, with the Black Death, the population was decimated. And this increased, like, the wages of the average laborer in the long run, like, rather dramatically, right? Because suddenly labor is more dear. And so, like, workers had amazing wages sort of in the century or two following the plague. But that doesn't mean that it was a great, like, a great experience, right? I think, you know, there are a lot of human dynamics at play when there's sociopolitical change, especially dramatic change or, you know, bad disasters like plagues or climate disaster. But, you know, the story is always more complicated than that. Yeah.
So speaking along those lines, you mentioned the end of the palaces a little while ago. What do you think, aside from that, are the most important shifts that we see between the late Bronze and the early Iron Ages in Greece?
There are a lot. You know, when we look at the archaeological record, it's a story, I think, that's dominated by change, although there certainly are some points of continuity. So when we talk about changes after the palatial collapse, one thing that we see is basically a lot of, like, negative space in the archaeological record. So a lot of the categories of material finds that are relatively abundant in the later Bronze Age, the palaces are painted with these frescoes, right, that show sort of different scenes of people or animals or sort of symbols. None of that continues after the palatial collapse. So sort of large-scale fresco painting is a category of sort of evidence that we lose. Glass is something that was produced in certain Mycenaean centers that's no longer being made. There's very little glass or sort of faience, which is a glass paste following the 12th century BC. Ivory, gold, silver artifacts are all sort of vanishingly rare in the archaeological record after 1200. The Linear B script, which is the writing system that was used in the palatial states, apparently is defunct. We don't have any more evidence of writing after about 1200. You already mentioned, so the palaces, right? So in general, monumental large-scale building projects are no longer undertaken. So in general, the archaeological picture becomes much sparser. There's always pottery, bronze artifacts, and then, you know, we find the remains of sort of mud brick huts with a little stone sort of foundation. So pretty simple and sort of less elaborately constituted material culture is certainly a big change. Well, we look at, like, the settlement record, we see a lot of geographical shifts, right, of what we would call the sort of center of gravity of the Aegean world. So as opposed to, say, you know, the Mycenaean palatial centers, we have the Argolid in the northeast Peloponnese, and then there's the big palace at Pylos in Messenia. There are several palatial states or entities in Boeotia. Those palaces are mostly destroyed. Some are sort of marginally reoccupied. But we see entirely different regions sort of becoming wealthier, it seems, and more connected. The northwestern Peloponnese, a region called Achaea, we see an explosion of really wealthy tombs after the palatial collapse there. And it seems like there are places that begin to thrive that were not so much thriving under the palatial administration and sort of vice versa. In general, we think the level of, like, socio-political organization changes. So as opposed to these sort of at least somewhat supra-regional hierarchical political entities, the sort of state devolved to something smaller and more simple. So we're probably looking at regional or even sort of village level hierarchies, which with less evidence for like, you know, a king and then vassals and sort of attaches, and more like what we would think of as like a chief and, you know, sort of like a big man in a village, that kind of thing. So lots of stuff changes. A lot of what we see is like fewer things and sort of less stuff. But there are also some innovations and sort of new things that are invented. So obviously iron is present now, and that's why we call it the Iron Age. So there's a switch from mostly using bronze for metallurgy to integrating iron. So that's a new technology that appears. Burial, we start seeing cremation burial in the Iron Age, whereas burial in the Bronze Age was entirely inhumation. So rather than burning the body, you just bury the body as it is. Instead of collective burial, we see individual burial more and more. You know, again, this is an interesting aspect of the scholarly conversation about the end of the Bronze Age, I think, in the Aegean, is it's often been seen as this big break. But people are now trying to think of it as more of a continuum. But, you know, you can sort of pile up the differences you see in various aspects of the archaeological record. And there must be some kind of like major changes in society, I think, that lurk behind those superficial things that we see.
So when we're talking about kind of the major shifts in society, one of the ones that seems to crop up again and again whenever there are studies of the settlement record is depopulation, and that there are just significantly fewer people living in the Aegean in the Iron Age than there are in the Late Bronze Age. I mean, so from your perspective, do you think that depopulation happened? If so, how significant was it? I mean, would you put a number on it? Do you think it's possible to do so?
Yeah, well, this is something I devoted a lot of time and energy to when I was working on my dissertation and in my book, because I was trying to talk about change in the economy. And anyone who works in the economy knows that, you know, understanding demography is really fundamental to understanding economic developments, because, you know, you could say, well, they had this much stuff in this period and this much stuff in the next period. But if you're just talking about that in the aggregate, you don't know the per capita change, right, in sort of prosperity or wealth or like quantities of anything, you can't really talk about like whether there was really more growth or less prosperity, or whether we're just looking at, you know, the same amount per capita, right? It's a pretty basic concept in studying the economy. Of course, it's very difficult to extract reliable demographic figures from prehistory because they didn't keep like census records, obviously, and we don't really have very good evidence for the Aegean anyway. So we have to sort of infer demographic change from archaeological proxy data, which is really a knotty problem to try to unravel, right? Because you could say, you could look at, say, burial evidence. If there are more tombs, maybe we could say that means there are probably more people. But of course, we know that in the ancient world, not everyone was like given access to archaeologically visible burial, right? So we're looking at probably some small percentage of the population, and cultures change regarding who is given access to burial. So you're not looking at like a steady indicator, right? When you look at burials, you know, we have evidence for settlements, but they're mostly not fully excavated. So we can't even say like how many hectares a site like Mycenae would have occupied, because we don't know the extent of the site. There are just a lot of unknowns and also known unknowns. So it gets into some pretty murky territory. I did my best to sort of combine a bunch of different proxies to sort of see, you know, maybe by like piling bad data onto other bad data, we could somehow achieve like a reliable number. You can do the best you can with the evidence available. From what I could see in these various proxies, it's not unreasonable to reconstruct a sort of 40 to 60% decrease in population between, say, the middle of the 13th century BC and, you know, the 11th century BC. So that's a huge difference. And it certainly would explain a lot of aspects of the archaeological record if we reconstruct a society that's not only simpler or different, but also, you know, has a much smaller sort of human footprint.
So this is something I want to come back to a little bit later when we talk a little bit more about trade and changes in trade. But where do you think the people went? What do you think happened to them?
I think to some extent, most people would reconstruct considerable out-migration. So we see a lot of sort of Mycenaean-style pottery and even Mycenaean-style buildings appearing in places like Cyprus, right, and the Levant around the time of the palatial collapse and afterwards, so the sort of post-palatial period. So it seems like at least some of the decline in population should be accounted for by people packing up and moving away to somewhere else. Probably there's some amount of people dying for whatever reason. I mean, we get the sense from the sort of destruction levels at some of the Mycenaean palaces that there were sort of burning events and that maybe there was a non-peaceful sort of abandonment of some of the sites. So we can reconstruct probably some unrest, right? And along with that, there probably was a certain amount of stabbing, which would lead to also some, you know, how large of a population change that could cause. I'm not sure. You know, it's always hard to be sure about these kind of granular events in the prehistoric period. But, you know, we also reconstruct now still sort of nebulously defined changes in the climate. So there could have been, you know, as we're sort of facing now, challenges with things like how much rainfall is coming, how much food you can grow, right? How many people the land can support. So probably, you know, as with many historical problems, there are a variety of causes. So I think a combination of people leaving and people dying would account for most of the attrition.
Well, that all makes a lot of sense. I mean, it feels like demographic change and especially demographic decline of that kind is really hard for people in the 21st century to wrap their heads around, because we're just always used to there being more people than there were a generation before. And that's been the case for, you know, 6, 7, 8 generations now. And so the idea that people just at some point might decide to stop having children because they don't think they can support them, or they never get the opportunity to do so, or there's some sort of major demographic catastrophe. I think that on some really basic level, that's hard for people to accept or understand in this day and age.
Yeah, I guess it's, I lived in Nebraska for a while. So I was thinking of sometimes I would teach the collapse and talk about the Dust Bowl, right? Which was a period in which big, you know, areas of agricultural land became uncultivable and like everybody just got up and left and moved west. And I think it has been interesting too, because it used to be that archaeologists, you know, maybe 20 years ago when I was taking my first classes, were not really open to the idea of like big migrations being a real force. But, you know, now we live in an era where like in the Mediterranean, we see a lot of migrants fleeing, you know, areas with wars and, you know, places that are no longer good for them to live in really large numbers. And again, the scholarly conversation is always in dialogue with what we're seeing in the world around us. So I think there's been a lot more attention paid recently to migration as a sort of powerful force that could happen at large scale in a short period of time. So it's all about always being a little self-critical about why we assume certain things could have happened and why we find other things implausible. Because I think there are examples in the sort of vast array of human historical scenarios, you know, there's always a precedent for anything if you want to find it.
Well, it's really interesting looking through the scholarship on this particular place and time, like on the Bronze Age Aegean and the Bronze Age Eastern Mediterranean, and looking at how the null hypothesis has kind of shifted. So there's a generation of scholars who were very comfortable saying that migration happened, then another generation of scholars who like kind of staked their identities on migration not being a thing that happened. And now it's getting harder on the basis of new kinds of evidence to say that this is not a thing that happened. And like watching the kind of like last-ditch attempts to fight against the resurgence of a migrationist paradigm in archaeology is really interesting.
Yeah, we do tend to get in these sort of like ping pong ball situations where like the entire paradigm will shift to one side and then it will eventually always comes back, I guess, sort of like a pendulum rather than a ping pong ball.
Well, bouncing a ping pong ball off a wall, I guess, like you're just really playing ping pong with yourself at some stage.
That is sometimes what I feel like as an archaeologist. I'm just playing a weird game of intellectual ping pong with myself.
Well, there are worse ways to pass the time. I think that's for sure.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You spent a lot of time studying trade. When we're trying to understand the late Bronze Age and the early Iron Age and the difference between them, what makes trade such a central topic to try to grasp those things?
For me, the reason I wanted to sort of go after this question of trade was that it had been positioned, or it is positioned, as a sort of linchpin, in a way, like tying the whole Bronze Age world system together, and sort of undergirding these complex states, right, that sort of ring the Eastern Mediterranean, in the sense that, you know, a common line of thinking is that the elites of the Bronze Age palaces are sort of dependent on their sort of brother kings, and like, I think you call it the Great Powers Club in your other podcasts, to sort of send them cool stuff that's not available locally, because it helps them to sort of reify their own status as like special guys that you have to pay attention to and you have to sort of do what they say. So from a point of view of political economy then, right, we would say that the trade, right, that was clearly sort of rather large in scale and relatively regular and sort of dependable in the late Bronze Age was an important aspect of, right, political messaging, right? That if you're the king of Mycenae and you can't get your special ostrich eggs from Egypt, then, you know, the peasants will think you're not a good king and they won't listen to your commands anymore and they won't move your giant cyclopean blocks or whatever, right? That's kind of the logic. So from that point of view, right, then we could imagine that part of the collapse involved the sort of pulling out of that linchpin, right? That something happened which impacted the ability of, say, the kings of these different states to access, right, these exotic and fancy materials from abroad, with which, you know, set off this chain of events where they could no longer curry favor with the nobles and they could no longer sort of lord it over everyone else with their fancy stuff. And this could have been connected to, right, the cause of the collapse. So I think, you know, it's always been theorized as part of the logic of this Bronze Age world system. And I think probably in some ways that's correct. But what I found a little difficult to square with that theory is that it's clear that in the 12th century, there still is trade occurring, and there sort of always is, right, in the Mediterranean. So if you really think that, say, the Mycenaean king's authority was in part sustained, right, by appeal to this special access, but we don't really see trade stopping when the palatial authority seems to disintegrate, then, right, the sort of whole logic of that theory seems to be undermined slightly. So that's kind of why I wanted to look at trade as an entity that changes over time, right? Because it sort of was a way to test this hypothesis in a way of the relationship between the kings and imported stuff and trade. But another interesting aspect of like the whole conversation is that people didn't really used to talk about trade that much when they studied the late Bronze Age. So Eric Klein, who's obviously written this wonderful book on the Bronze Age collapse, his early work was on sort of looking at imported objects in the Aegean. And before that, no one really thought there were very many of them or that they're really important. So it's really been in the last kind of 20 or 30 years that this has been at the attention of at least Bronze Age Aegean scholars. So, yeah, we talk about trade a lot now. I think another big thing that happened, this is just like how contingent like our scholarly attentions are, was the Ulurbrun ship, right, was discovered. And it's just this amazing archaeological like time capsule of Bronze Age merchant ship with these like cargoes of ingots and Canaanite jars and these really interesting like possessions of sailors. I think that really captured a lot of people's attention. And, you know, I think a lot of people started working on trade because they just thought the Ulurbrun ship was so cool and wanted to like understand the whole system that lay behind this amazing find. Which I think is great. One of the great things about archaeology is we find amazing stuff that makes your sort of jaw slacken, and then you get interested in it. So a lot of the sort of move towards like thinking Bronze Age trade is really important and worthy of discussion comes from just like really amazing discoveries that really capture a lot of imaginations.
I mean, I think there's a lot of really striking and cool things about the Ulurbrun shipwreck, but like the sheer quantity of goods in the ship is ridiculous. I mean, there's 11 tons of metal in there. Like, that's a huge amount of metal. That's not a tiny little bit of like prestige trade. Like, that is a bulk trade in a commodity. And one of the things that I really liked about your book and the way that you approach this material was, you know, instead of looking for these tiny little objects for display, you were talking about commodities and about the role that commodities would have played in this kind of political economy. So you took a quantitative approach. And I mean, so what does this give you? If you're looking at commodities and you're looking at quantities rather than kind of individual objects, how does that change your understanding of Mycenaean trade?
Good questions. The book was published in 2017. And that means I wrote most of it between like 2010 and 2015. So sometimes I forget exactly what I was doing in the book when people ask me about it. Which I think is also funny because when I was younger, I would ask scholars about their books, which seemed like a polite thing to do. And then sometimes they would tell me the same thing, like, I don't really remember that book anymore. And I thought, like, how could that be possible? You wrote that book. Like, you must think about it all the time. And then you realize, like, you know, you sort of move on. And then it begins to settle in the haze of the hard drive somewhere.
I think especially because usually by the time you've gotten to the point of writing it down, it stopped being interesting to you and you're just writing it down because you have to write it down so that you have the book when like your interest in the topic was satisfied when you found the answer to whatever question was driving you in the first place.
Yeah, you know, you've published a book. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, I have no idea what I wrote. None.
That's why you write it down, you know, so you can check later.
Absolutely.
But I would say that one of the things that became clear to me as I was looking at the quantitative record for the sort of most obvious category of archaeological material that we can use as a proxy for trade, which are like imported finished goods, that is things that we find in the archaeological record that were clearly not made in the place where they ended up. So things like Egyptian scarabs in the Aegean or like Canaanite jars, which is a special kind of jar that they make in the Levantine coast. We can identify these rather easily as like something that was definitely coming from somewhere else. But the thing that's interesting about the Aegean is that there just aren't that many of these sort of imported finished goods in any period of the Bronze Age or the early Iron Age, right? So they're sort of vanishingly rare artifacts, especially if you sort of, again, did what I was trying to do, which is sort of meter that by like per capita or per annum sort of imports. So if we think about just these sort of luxury elite goods as a sort of social force, like the quantities that are preserved, like don't really support the idea that these were like powerful, sort of politically active artifacts. Of course, it's always hard to interpret quantities in the archaeological record because there's lots of stuff we don't find, right? There's lots of stuff that's probably still out there. There's lots of stuff that just like doesn't survive. But, you know, from the evidence we had, if you looked at like how many of these sort of elite imported finished objects we had in the late Bronze Age and the post-palatial period and the early Iron Age, the numbers didn't change that much, especially if, as I did, you factor in per capita change And they just weren't very many ever. But I think that under, you know, that's then why I should have turned to the commodity question. Because what's also clear is that in the late Bronze Age, we do have evidence for like the circulation of massive quantities of commodities that don't show up in the archaeological record as like sort of finished, easily identifiable goods like an Egyptian scarab, but in transformed things like bronze ingots or copper and tin ingots into bronze swords, probably ivory objects have to be made from ivory, which doesn't come from Greece, but they're sort of made into Aegean type objects when we get there. So I think there was a lot more trade in the Mycenaean world than there was probably 200 years later. But I think that's more apparent when we consider commodity trade than when we just consider objects that are sort of, you know, for elite display or just like, you know, random exotic objects that we can identify.
The other thing I really liked about the way that you approached the material was you looked at where the objects were found. And you would expect if these elite objects were being used to advertise power and authority and status, that they would be giving them out to people as like kind of a way that the kings would be giving them out and saying like, okay, you know, you're my important guy. You get one, you get a nice thing and you get a car and you get a car and like all that. But that's not where the objects are found. They're found in kind of like weird out of the way spots in the palaces. They're not in like prominent spots where people would see them at times of display. They don't seem to fulfill that function. I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and I think it just shows the importance of always interpreting artifacts in their proper archaeological context. Because when you do that, you know, you sort of see that a lot of the elite exotica that were interpreted, you know, in just in the way that you said that the reason you want these things is you can, you know, sort of give them away to your friends and sort of make friends that way and sort of curry favor with people sort of maybe at a lower level of the hierarchical chain. But that doesn't seem to be happening, right? We don't see, you know, something like these imported objects. Some of them are at the palace and then some of them are sort of in the nearby center that had been given as a gift, right? They really are concentrated just in the palaces, at least in the palatial period. And they seem to often have more of like a ritual function than a straightforward, obvious political function. And I thought that was really interesting because, again, it's something that didn't fit the model, which is always fun because it gives you something new to think about. But I also think it kind of helps us understand more what Mycenaean trade was about, right? I don't think it was about getting fancy trinkets that can sort of be displayed as some sort of method of self-aggrandizing behavior. I think it was much more about acquiring various commodities that were dear because they were hard to acquire locally, but then transforming those right into the things that people in the Aegean wanted, right? Rather than a scarab, which is not that useful to them, right? So you see a lot more like importing commodities, bronze, ivory, right? Stuff that's hard to get in the Aegean, and then sort of making it into cool stuff, but that's Aegean in style. So that gives us, I think, a little bit of a slightly altered understanding of like what exactly these palatial elites were after when they engaged in trade.
It makes them seem much more intensely pragmatic if the way that you're looking at these imports and this trade is that what my underlings really want are swords. So I'm going to get copper and tin from the guy that I know on Cyprus. I'm going to get 11 tons of it, and I'm going to make 300 sets of armor and swords. Like, that's the kind of thing that makes a ton of sense if you're just trying to imagine being a king in the Mycenaean world in a way that what I really want is some Egyptian scarabs maybe doesn't translate quite as directly. So
yeah, and I think it's like one thing, you know, that maybe is not so much acknowledged is that maybe the Mycenaeans were a little bit, you know, of a sort of thug mafioso state, right? Like, what do they really want? They want swords, and that's what they're going to get, and that's what they're sort of into. But it makes them seem more like politically modern too. Mm-hmm. A lot of these models about like the prestige value of the exotic come from sort of anthropological or ethno-archaeological studies of like Pacific Island communities. I mean, how they would have these like sort of special beads and shells that would travel amongst communities. And they did have this sort of power as the evidence of distance, right? So like there's a lot of really good scholarship written on this kind of model. The Bronze Age states maybe, though, were less interested in that kind of display. I'm more, as you said, interested in like the sort of hard matter of governing the territory, right? Which is, you know, you have to use coercive force to maintain the order. And I think swords were helpful with that. So it makes them seem like sort of more pragmatic, I suppose, which is interesting.
Well, I mean, the thing that I really liked about your book as I was reading through it, because I read a ton of scholarship on Mycenaean Greece, and I read through the press, all of the stuff on prestige goods. And I just couldn't quite square it in my head with the evidence for Mycenaean trade more generally. So like what gets passed on from Mycenaean Greece into Central Europe and Italy, right? Like what kind of trade that is, the kinds of objects that are being traded, the kinds of people that they're dealing with, you know, what they're trying to barter for, but trying to make sense of that and also kind of the economic role of the palaces, where like the way that you presented it makes a ton of sense, because if what they're importing are commodities, and then what they're doing in the palaces is they're adding value by transforming those commodities into things that people want, the palaces still have a central economic role, which seems very clear from all the evidence that we have. It makes sense in terms of kind of the greater Bronze Age world system with how trade functions. And, you know, it's not like where you have large quantities of goods that are being shipped. Like whoever had the Uluburun ship wasn't going to do retail trade a pound of copper at a time. Like there has to be a center of demand for that cargo, right? Like there has to be, you know, one or two or three consumers who are going to take the bulk of that. And so like, I liked your book and the way that you presented this material brought all that together and made it make sense, which is a kind of a rare thing. So I wanted to thank you for that, because it made the whole thing a lot more kind of consonant with my understanding of how these things should probably have worked. It just made a lot of sense.
Great. Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I'm glad it made sense. That's the goal.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/.
Let's talk a little bit more about kind of quantitative methods. So this is something you use in this book, and it's something you've talked a lot about in your other publications. A lot of archaeologists are really excited about quantitative data. There are a lot of archaeologists really excited about the possibilities of big data. What are things we need to be careful about with quantitative approaches and with big data?
Yeah. What big data, I think, from archaeological context shows you most often is like where the holes in the archaeological data are, right? Because our archaeological data are all this sort of weird construct, right? We think of the data as the data, right? If we have this many copper ingots, we have these huge walls that were built by this many people, right? It probably would have taken this long and this much effort. We're dealing with these concrete things, right, in the archaeological record. And so it makes sense that we can say concrete things about them, right, in terms of their quantity. So there's this sort of hard surface of the numbers that seems like pretty stable. But the archaeological record is just this sort of turtles all the way down sort of entity, right? In the sense that there are all these layers of things that like filter out from what ancient reality was to like what we actually have. So things that don't survive in the archaeological record, sites we haven't found yet, things that have been found but looted, right? So we don't actually have the data. Sites that, you know, have been found but not published, which happens a lot. So it's really difficult to go confidently forward with archaeological data sets to any kind of conclusion about what happened in the ancient past. What I find them useful for is that they can often show you like what's probably missing, right? In the sense that some of the data sets that I built, or the purpose of one of the data sets that I built, was to try to understand whether we might have fewer archaeological sites dated to the early Iron Age versus the late Bronze Age, because archaeologists haven't been as interested in that period, right? And so we might just have fewer sites because people haven't been looking for them. So I tracked the sort of discovery date of all the sites we had for both periods, and I tried to see whether like the rate of discovery of early Iron Age sites had increased in the last like 30 years when people got really interested in the early Iron Age. but it didn't happen that way. So it seemed like probably people had been pretty good about sort of finding and reporting these sites over time. So we can't really use that to explain, right, the variance in site quantities from period to period. So I kind of try to use the quantitative data sets as a way to be critical about like what might be wonky about the data and what we might be able to explain about like what's there, what's not there. But I think the key with these data sets is like to know exactly where the data comes from and who made it. Because also like encoding archaeological information into numbers involves a lot of judgment calls, a lot of decisions, right? A lot of things we can't date very precisely. So you have to decide whether you're going to put it into one bucket or the other. So you get a lot of sort of messiness in these data sets. So it's kind of hard to use them in the sort of scale of like a big data as we beat it in society in general, right? That there are these data sets out there you can like grab them off the internet and use them for whatever you want. Archaeological data sets, I think, have to be pretty bespoke, right? And you kind of have to build them to do what you want to do with them. And you need to really know like what was in the sausage, right? How the sausage was made. Because otherwise, I think you won't understand all the many potential problems with these data sets.
I'm loving the idea of archaeological data as just like a chicken pot pie with a hard exterior and then a gooey interior, where once you get down there, you're like, oh, that's just a mess. Like that's really kind of all over the place. I have a really good friend who's a data scientist, like a really high level data scientist. And one of the things he's fond of saying is that the data is sick. It's sick. And that you know, like you can run whatever kind of analyses you want, but if the data itself is bad or flawed or biased in some way, it's not really going to tell you a whole lot aside from, you know, what kind of assumptions you're bringing to bear and the methods that you're taking to it. Like when I did my doctoral dissertation, I looked at every letter written in Latin between about 450 and 600 AD. And then I plotted where they were sent from and where they were sent to. And what I found was that there were just no short distance letters. Like nobody was sending a letter 20 miles. That just did not appear in the data set at all. And so either people weren't keeping those letters or they were sending oral messages instead. It was just an entire category of text that you think should exist that didn't. There's no record of it at all. So yeah, I mean, when you're like, you're limited by what you can find and what you can record. And so like, if you're looking for bulk commodity trade, but it's in perishable goods, like what kind of evidence of that are you ever going to see in the archaeological record? It's like there's all sorts of things that are just not going to be visible.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the fun parts of the puzzle. And that's kind of why I like to use quantitative methods, because at a certain level, if you want to say something like there was more trade or there was less trade in this period and this period, like, what do you mean by that, right? We have to have some kind of quantitative estimates or to at least start to try to reconstruct, right, at least in a ballpark way, the kind of numbers we're dealing with. Because it's really hard to, I think, engage in arguments that don't provide some quantitative basis, right? Because what I mean by a lot of trade might be totally different from what you mean by a lot of trade. And then we're disagreeing with each other, but we don't really know what each other are talking about. So I think it's, even though the data is flawed, you know, especially from the point of view of like economic assessment, if we're going to try to like sort of measure the performance of these economies, how they changed over time, we can be creative and we can try to come up with our best estimates for these kind of archaeological invisible aspects of trade, like bulk commodities, things like demography or population. Like, we're never going to be precisely correct, I think, about any of that data, but we can think about an estimate, right? That gets us pretty much in a general ballpark.
I think there's a good lesson there in terms of dealing with data in general, regardless of what your field is, that like paying attention to where the data comes from, how it's collected, and what exactly it is that it's measuring. I think that's stuff that people in more fields would be well suited to spend more time on. Like, I think it's one of the things that drives historians nuts about economists is when they just grab the data that somebody painstakingly put together over, you know, the course of 50 years in Florentine archives and then tries to do stuff with it. And it's like, but you don't know what the data is actually saying or what these records are. Like, you see that a lot with like late medieval census records, right? Which is an incredibly esoteric topic that I've spent probably more time on than I should have. Like, the people who were taking those censuses, those kinds of censuses, had very specific things that they were doing and people that they were looking for and people who actually counted. So if you want to use them to reconstruct late medieval demography, well, like, there were whole categories of people that they didn't think they needed to write down because they didn't count, literally didn't count. But if you just take that data set out of context and then try to turn it into some sort of like timeless objective record of the human experience, you're going to be missing some really important things. But the fact that archaeologists should, in theory, be thinking hard about their data and what it says and what it can't say, I mean, that's what everybody should be doing, but rarely does.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, when I was in grad school, we read a lot of stuff by this guy, Edward Tufte, who is a sort of, I guess he works on data visualization, right? He's written several books on sort of best practices in data visualization. And, you know, he talks a lot about how it's very easy to lie with data because people have this inherent trust in numbers. And if you give them a chart that shows like oil prices, like over time, and it looks quantitative, like most people just say, okay, well, that's the truth, right? Those are the numbers. And we have this sort of inherent trust of the strong rhetoric of arguments that are presented with numbers. So I think the world would be a better place if more people were critical of the source of quantitative data and also the way it's sort of used to try to make points that can't be contested, right? Because it's the numbers, right? We can't argue with it. But indeed, you know, you can for sure.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot about the tendency among paleoanthropologists to do a lot of skull measuring and use that as a proxy for, you know, the relatedness of various specimens in a collection, where like some problems with that. There's some issues, but it looked quantitative. And it's not that it tells you nothing, but does it tell you exactly what they thought that was telling you 60 or 70 years ago? Probably not. So we've been talking for a while, and I kind of want to wind us down here. But as you're thinking about the stuff that you're working on right now, kind of the future of your field, what's most interesting and most exciting to you as you're kind of planning out the next few years, thinking ahead?
Yeah, I think anyone you asked in archaeology today would be excited about the sort of new uses of science in the field, various new like analytical techniques, and the things that they open up that would have seemed impossible probably 20 years ago. I think this is especially important in the study of trade, because when we're talking about trade as a sort of part of the economy, part of what we want to know is like where stuff came from and where it ended up. And some of that we could sort of be pretty clear on. Like, we know that hippopotamus ivory must have come from Egypt because there aren't hippopotami in the Aegean, right? It's pretty straightforward. But for a long time, no one thought it was possible to source tin, right? We had to sort of infer where tin came from based on some textual records and sort of where we know there are modern tin sources. But recent sort of combinatorial analyses of isotopic aspects of tin remains are being developed so that we can actually say, you know, this tin likely comes from one of these sources based on the sort of scientific evidence. So there are a lot of new advances occurring in the fields of like materials analysis that are, I think, helping sort of clarify, and in some cases sort of like totally shock us in our understanding of the political geography of these traded goods. And then there's like other stuff that we didn't even think about before that scientists are now learning how to identify. So probably the article that blew my mind the most that I've read recently was a big collaborative paper. It was in Nature about evidence from tooth enamel of skeletons from Tiryns, a palace in the Argolid, and then Hania, which is a palatial site in Crete, that show that they frequently inhaled smoke that contained lignite, which is a sort of soft brown coal that occurs naturally in various parts of Greece. So they were showing that these people probably were like working in metallurgical contexts, burning large amounts of this lignite, which is, you know, you would find it probably in like northwestern Greece or the Peloponnese. There are certain places we know it comes from, right? But so now we're thinking like, oh, we were thinking about traded metals, but you know what else you need to make metals is a lot of fuel. And so now we're thinking about, right, moving these large amounts of like soft brown coal around. And that's like a topic that didn't even exist right before this sort of method developed. So there's lots of cool stuff like that, I think, that will make the next, you know, years really exciting. I guess that's kind of like an obvious answer. Probably any archaeologist would say, oh, cool science stuff. But I think another really cool trend that I'm excited about is increasing emphasis archaeologically on like excavating sort of more people from different sectors of the economy. So obviously we've often focused on elites and palatial people and like people living in fancy houses buried in fancy tombs. But I think there's a lot more interest now in assessing economic performance based on how everybody's living, right? So we might say the Mycenaean and palatial states were rich and like they were doing so well. But if we look at sort of regular people's lives or regular people's tombs, and we see that like the wealth is just all being like sort of monopolized by this greedy fat king at the top of the heap, you know, that should change how we assess these economies in sort of comparative perspective. So I think there's a lot more critical understanding of sort of how we think about ancient economic performance and how wealth was distributed, again, in dialogue with sort of more critique of modern economic obsessions with growth and that kind of thing. So there are lots of cool young scholars doing really interesting work on the ancient economy that takes a totally different approach, I think, that sets aside some of the old assumptions that we made. So lots of cool, exciting stuff happening.
I mean, I've talked to so many bioarchaeologists while I've been doing this series on like prehistory and early historic periods, and the richness of human remains as a source for talking about the past is just, I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. And pretty much every one of them that I talk to has some new mind-blowing thing to tell me about how human remains can be used as a source. And the idea that you don't have to have grave goods like or a copious quantity of grave goods to talk about somebody's life, that instead the evidence of that is going to be written on their bones in a whole variety of ways, is just mind-boggling. I mean, like, that's an incredible thing. And especially if you're interested in the lives of ordinary people, and especially their kind of corporeal experience and, you know, what it's like to live in their bodies on a day-to-day basis, like the fact that you can infer that in some way from their remains is like, that's pretty revolutionary in the same way that the scientific stuff is. It opens up an entirely different and more human way of understanding people.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And it's so great that so much more of that is being done now. There's a big cemetery from the post-palatial period that I've spent a lot of time working on. It's called Perati. It's the site in East Attica. And it's a huge cemetery. It's like 200 plus chamber tombs with multiple burials. Like, all the bones were just thrown away. It was excavated back in the 50s and 60s. So it's the kind of thing where when we think about how we treated human remains as not sort of the most interesting part of the context for so many years and how much was lost, it's kind of depressing. But that's water under the bridge. And we have all these great bioarchaeologists now doing such amazing work. And as you said, it's just opens up all these new avenues of analysis that would have seemed unimaginable, you know, back 50 years ago.
On that note, Professor Murray, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for your work, and I hope we get to talk again.
Yeah, thanks a lot. This was great. And I really enjoy the podcast, so I'm going to keep listening.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, God, I hope I don't screw anything up. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles,
and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.